It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. What an interesting day the last couple of days have been, watching Republican governors who have been spending their time figuring out how can we possibly make desperate workers even more desperate? How can we go after those unemployed, strip them of the federal benefits? Because that $300, that $300 a week is just too darn generous. It's making people lazy, making them not want to take those crummy jobs, not making them want to go back into dangerous working conditions for poverty wages. And we can't have that. So we need to make them desperate. Even you got Joe Biden. You're Joe Biden saying, look, if you're offered a suitable job, you got to take it. My question is, what is suitable? If you can't feed your family on a job, is that suitable? And I think that's playing right into the Republican framework that there are workers out there who are they're not going back because they're getting all these wonderful benefits. And again, as I said the other day, the reality is of unemployment is, and this is universal across all the states, if you were employed and your employer calls you back to work and you choose not to go back, you're no longer unemployed. You're no longer eligible for unemployment. That's how the game works. So if people are calling their former workers back and saying, hey, you now come back to work, there's a path for that. And it's one of these moments where you go, Is this really about that they can't find people to work, or is it they need this as a political football? Now, look, you've got the governor of, what is it, Iowa, I guess, today, Kim Reynolds coming out saying we're going to end the state's participation, the federal government, I guess sometime early June, cutting off that lifeline for folks. And look, you got Mississippi, you've got Arkansas, you got Alabama. You got South Carolina. You got, did I say Montana? You got that idiot out there too. You've got all these Republican governors who are now on the same page because this, they didn't think of this stuff on their own. This is part of a national playbook because it's simple, really simple. Get those women back in the kitchen, making me my dinner and cleaning up my mess. Pretty simple. Because understand. Most of the low-wage workforce that we're talking about in the restaurant and hospitality industry is, yes, you guessed it, single mothers, young women, older women, mostly women. See, there's a common theme there, mostly women. So oddly enough, when single moms have to take care of their kids who still schools haven't completely opened up again, you kind of got to wonder, how are we playing this? Because we don't have a child care system in this country. So what do you expect to do with them? I think of South Carolina a number of years ago. A woman had her kid play across the street at the park. 9-year-old kid was across the street playing at the park while mom was across the street at the McDonald's working. Police came, arrested her, took her away. Child abuse. Leaving your child to play in the park? How dare you? And now what we're saying is, sorry, we're going to steal what little lifeline you had to be able to make it through the rest of this pandemic and still support your family and still take care of your kids. Sorry, that's done. Back to work. And what's interesting to me is yesterday the story dropped about Jeff Bezos. Bezos evidently has bought a giant, buying a giant triple-masted $500 million super yacht. I guess it's going to be the largest thing ever built that floats. Do you think he's doing it here? Do you think the Y-721 is going to be built here in the U.S.? No. It's going to be built by a Dutch company, and it's going to be registered, I believe it was Panama? And I'm going, hold on a second. Because here's the thing. Here's what we're told. We're told we got to give rich people all the money because, well, they hire poor people. The article that I was reading on the super yacht. The guy who evidently does super yacht research has told Bloomberg News that the super yacht market roaring, never better. Super yachts are flying off the shelf. Yet we can't seem to get a single mother a couple hundred extra bucks a week in her unemployment so that she can take care of her kids and put food on the table. And oh, by the way, spend money in those businesses that are now reopening. It's pretty interesting to me because, you know, we're told that the very wealthy, they're the ones who take care of us, the benevolent. I mean, we are the richest country in the history of history. We're the richest country in the history of forever. And yet, sorry, you poor people got to go back to those crummy jobs. And I'll go back to what I said, forever. What happened to competition? What happened to bringing those people back to work and enticing them with better wages, hours, and conditions? What happened to competition? What happened to the free market going, hey, we got a shortage of workers. We need to compete for those workers with higher wages and better things like better hours, better working conditions. Because you ask any of these people who work in the hospitality industry, restaurants, hotels, bars, any of this stuff, they're horrible conditions. Dealing with people is horrible. I wouldn't want to do it. I don't want anybody else to have to do it. And to entice these people to come back after being locked up for 16 months, can you imagine how unbearable we are to have to deal with after now the gates flood open and all of these Karens and Carls and crazy people rushing to the local watering hole? Can you imagine? And you're going to do that for, what, $2.96 an hour plus tips? Because, yes, that is the federal minimum wage for tipped employees. And you wonder, well, we can't get people to come work for barely minimum wage. It's crazy. So what you've got is you got the Republicans who are in these Republican-led states. And there are going to be more. Trust me, there are going to be many more who are pushing this idea that we need to force people back to work. We need to force them out, make them desperate enough and hungry enough so that they'll do it. And look, this is a political winner for them. I absolutely agree it's a political winner because it does a whole bunch of things. It gives them a target for the rage machine. Gives the rage machine someone to attack. Those lazy people, how dare they? They're getting something I'm not. I'm paying for it. It works perfectly. It's beautiful. It gives them someone vulnerable and defenseless to target on, to beat up on, to attack, because they know those people can't defend themselves. And they can stoke that jealousy. How come I don't get that? That race hatred that we all love so much. You can stoke, of course, you know, attacking those single mothers, punishing those single mothers. How dare they? I mean, it's a winner, because especially on the right, because it gets to tick off all of those angry boxes, and it gets to keep people all riled up. And it's just those people down there anyway. It's not hardworking people like us, just those lazy people. It's always amazing to me. You know, and I talk to people all the time about, have you ever worked with lazy people? Oh, yeah. It turns out half the people you ask that question to are the lazy people themselves. This is a political winner. Understand that for them. And the Republicans get it because they get to change the topic. Because they have no agenda. They have no policy. They have no way to make working conditions better. All they have to do is make people desperate enough. Force people's hands into being desperate enough to force them back into horrible conditions. And then shame them. You know, here in Pennsylvania, we have this thing going on as well. Where, you know, we're stripping power away from a Democratic governor because that's their aim, without thinking that, you know, someday down the road we may have a Republican who may want to do something. Doesn't matter. They're trying to strip power from government to be able to respond to crisis so that they can never do this stuff again. Never make sure that people's unemployment is secure and that they get a little bit extra so that they can survive a global pandemic. And what's really twisted to me is that you get working people who are looking at other working people and saying, you don't deserve, you don't need. It's really remarkable, while not looking at someone like Bezos or our billionaire class, who literally, in the moment that we need them the most, are walking away from us. It's, you know, I know, but Rick, you know, he pays $15 an hour at Amazon. Yeah, but here's the thing. Those jobs 30 years ago were paying in today's dollars $25 an hour with healthcare benefits and all kinds of stuff. And not the kind of robotic, hyper-managed working conditions that you see today. And the thing is I look at this. I look at this moment. And the Republicans, they're masters at divide and conquer. They're masters at picking the targets and going after them. If it's not the bathroom issue, if it's not the marriage issue, if it's not, you know, the most way out extreme religious issue, it's this. They've picked their targets because they know who they're targeting. These are folks at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder. These are people who are struggling to begin with. And at finally a point in their life, things have gotten just a touch better. And now they're saying, no, you got to go back to that. We need someone to cook us dinner and clean up our mess. And it's really playing into this political move on the right of restraining governmental power to respond to crisis and bringing the craziest of the crazy out into the political sphere. You know, I came across an article the other day over at ProPublica where, you know, now you've got the people who rioted on January 6th, calling them the 1-6ers. You know, they're now taking pride in the fact that they attacked the Capitol. Now, understand, it's always been my belief that there are Republicans who would have cheered on 9/11 if the DNC headquarters was in one of the Twin Towers. You saw after Oklahoma City, and it's coming out now because of Josh Hawley, that there were the defenders of the militia types, Josh Hawley being one of them. That's who these people have always been. And this is what I've said for a very long time. It's not about country for them. It's about power. Pure unadulterated power, their economic gain. Who benefits by forcing these low-wage workers back into poverty wages? Well, corporate America, you know, big conglomerates. But also upper-middle-class white business owners. They seem to do really well. And I keep coming back to this moment of in the world that they keep telling us they believe in, you know, invisible hand, competition, reward for work. They keep telling us they believe this stuff. When it comes down to action, not so much. I'm even seeing right now people who have been sending me stuff, you know, conservative stuff over the years, now talking about guest worker programs. Well, if those people won't go back to work, we'll just bring in people to replace them. Again, it's all about the cheap labor. It's all about the exploitive labor. Instead of saying, you know, how can we encourage people? How can we make things better? Like the childcare issue. For me, the childcare issue for women, the single biggest issue that they've got going on right now. You want people to come back to those jobs, figure out how to get them childcare. Because guess what? The schools, they're still not completely open. And I know this is where you got people running for school boards all across the country going, we should add kids back in school. I actually had someone tell me today, and this is one of those really bizarre moments. I actually had someone tell me today that if we did nothing during the pandemic, you did nothing at all, fewer people would have died. And look, here's the great part about their argument. You can't prove them wrong. You can't go back and retest it. You can't go back and say, well, you know, this is what would have happened. Because they go, look at Florida. I go, yeah, look at Florida. I don't trust anything that's come out of Florida. I don't really trust anything that's come out of the state governments for a while because they're all trying to fudge the numbers. I think the death toll from the virus has been much higher. I think many more people have been sick with it. But again, this is a political game they keep throwing back and forth at us. But I had this guy telling me that, you know, more people died because of staying home. Because families weren't protecting themselves. I go, but they're home. They're with their families. That they were still spreading. And I'm going, oh, so being at home with your family, worse than being in large crowds with thousands of people. And that seems to be the thought process, which is kind of frightening. Because there's part of me that goes, no matter what you tell this person, as long as there's an R attached to the statement, going to buy it. And the Republican machine has been funding think tanks and writers and thought leaders for such a long time that have been spewing this stuff that people buy it. And it's one of those things that just kind of, on a certain level, defies logic. But I go back to the reality. All of that stuff aside, we're still looking at each other in the working class. We're still looking at the person who's struggling to find a job. The business owner who claims there aren't people out there willing to work for minimum wage. And we're not focusing on the Bezoses and the obscene wealth that has been just hoarded during this pandemic. And it's quite remarkable to me. And I guess on the other side, we'll look back on this and I hope reevaluate and I hope do something policy wise. If we ever have another one of these, if we're around in 100 years, but I fear not. I fear we're so divided, so polarized that no matter where the attack comes from, it's all going to be viewed through a political lens. Scary times. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Do you know anyone who's unemployed, who's decided not to because they're lazy? I'd love to hear it. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
There's nothing more American than workers standing up. And the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1967. That was the day United Farm Workers Sons of Zapata joined with the Confederation of Mexican Workers in establishing an international picket line across the Rio Grande Valley. A push to organize farm workers at 6 major growers began the year before in the spring of 1966. Wages in Starr County ranged from 40 to 85 cents an hour. Farm workers began their strike in June of 1966 for wage increases and union recognition. But growers would rather see their crops rot than recognize the union. They did grant wage increases, but immediately ran to the courts for injunctions. One district judge outlawed all picketing, while police instructed county workers to spray the strikers with insecticide. That August, workers voted to organize with the United Farm Workers and began a pilgrimage march to the state capitol to popularize their cause. 15,000 workers and their supporters reached Austin on Labor Day to demand their right to organize. They returned to Starr County to continue their strike. The growers turned to Mexican commuters holding green cards to break the strike. The United Farm Workers began picketing at Roma and Rio Grande City bridges and were often successful in turning back green card workers. By May 1967, melon harvest had begun. After months of negotiations, picket lines went up on both sides of the international bridges. The picketing was 100% successful for 2 days. But the Mexican government and Starr County Sheriff's Department soon intervened to break up the picket lines. Texas Rangers were brought in to arrest and brutalize strikers. The strike was broken, but organizing continued throughout the region. Picketing across borders was itself an important act of international solidarity. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'm still hung up on the $500 million super yacht, triple mast super yacht, made overseas, flagged overseas. I wonder if it'll ever touch U.S. soil, or maybe it'll just ride around and go, ha ha. Maybe it'll laugh from the shore. I don't know. And look at all the money that we spent to help build his little boat. It's crazy. And yet we still don't have people in D.C. going, yeah, we should be taxing those folks a little bit higher because we've got needs. We've got health care that people need. We've got homeless veterans on the street. We've got kids hungry. We got so many things that we need to do. But, hey, remember, those rich people spend the money and they give us poor people jobs. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on their latest incredible report. The Institute for Policy Studies has released their 27th annual Executive Excess Report, Pandemic Pay Plunder. I've got one of the folks who's high into that, Sarah Anderson. She's a Global Economy Project Director and the co-editor of inequality.org and one of the folks behind Pandemic Pay Plunder. Say that 10 times fast. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So how bad is it? How bad was the plunder? How full are their pockets? And has anything ever spilled out of those pockets for the rest of us to fight over?
Well, that's what we wanted to look at in this report. And so the way we went about it is we looked at the 100 S&P 500 corporations with the lowest median worker pay. So these are 100 of the largest low-wage employers in America. And we wanted to see in a year of such great suffering for low-wage workers and a year when so many of them were demonstrating how essential they are to our economy and our public health, did these companies alter their pay practices at all? And what we found was that, yes, most of them did alter their pay practices, but it was mostly to inflate their CEO pay. So 51 of these 100 low-wage employers had rigged their own rules to inflate their CEO pay. And I can give a few examples so people know what I'm talking about. One example would be Carnival Cruise Line, which had employees stranded out on ships in the middle of the ocean. They could not get home. And yet the board gave the CEO a retention award, which boosted his pay to $13 million. Well, they still had people stuck on those ships. And that made his pay about 500 times as much as their median worker pay. And I can give you a lot more examples of how corporations bent over backwards to shield their CEO from pandemic risk, while it was the frontline workers who were really out there keeping our economy going and facing the highest risks.
Now, during the whole pandemic, we heard a lot. They were heroes, frontline heroes, essential workers. And a couple of them gave out some pennies and some praise, nice press releases. But those pennies didn't stay because a lot of those corporations then, they gave it and then taketh away, a short time later. In fact, I look at Kroger, one of the areas, raised, you said, hey, if you're going to call these people heroes and essential, you're going to pay them. They ended up bailing out of the state altogether.
Yeah, and we looked at Chipotle, where, again, the CEO did not meet his bonus goals, but the company came in anyway and moved the bonus goalposts so that he could get a $38 million compensation package. Now, they were one of those companies that offered a little bit of hazard pay in the beginning of the pandemic. They gave them a 10% increase on their base wage, which average pay at Chipotle has been $12 an hour. So they were giving people $1.20 an hour extra to go back into those restaurants and take those high risks. But as you said, they cut off that hazard pay. after a few months. So in the fall, when the infection rate started going up again, most of these companies that had offered low-wage workers hazard pay had already cut it off. They also claimed that they offered paid COVID leave time to their workers, but there were a lot of their workers said, hey, nobody informed us of that. And when I went to ask for leave time, my manager told me to take unpaid leave. So now you've got a situation where Chipotle just announced yesterday that they're scrambling to hire people to staff their restaurants. And you were talking about this earlier about the so-called labor shortage. Well, I have to think if Chipotle and others had treated their workers a little bit better during the pandemic, they wouldn't be in this situation now where they claim to have a labor shortage.
No, it's an excellent point. And I go back to my original thought, which has been, if you need people to come work for you, you got to pay them better. I mean, if there is truly a shortage and as you've said, you treated them poorly, you got to entice them back with something better, better treatment, better pay, better hours, whatever.
Absolutely. And maybe not bend the rules so that the guy in the corner office gets these absurd pay packages. I mean, think of how demoralizing that would have been for workers who are really putting themselves at risk every day for that company. But the guy, shielded away in the corner office is the one that they're doing cartwheels to make sure that he gets this massive payout.
I mean, it's mind blowing to me it's right in front of us. And yet, we're still fighting over, these kind of bizarre things like the unemployment thing. I'm still stuck on this. I just to compare Bezos and his $500 million super yacht to some single mother in Mississippi getting an extra couple hundred bucks to be able to feed her family. It's just nuts. And that's who we're attacking. It's nuts to me.
Absolutely. And especially at a time when, like I said, these workers have been out there on the front lines, keeping our economy and our society functioning. And if there ever was a time for us to rethink our reward system and how skewed it is, I had to read all of these corporate proxy statements, which is where they lay out what their executive compensation plans are, and they justify these ridiculous, rule rigging maneuvers to pump up the CEO pay. And one after another said, well, this was critical to retain top talent. They still have this mindset that it's this one individual in the corner office who's almost single-handedly creating the company value, when, of course, it's the people out there actually doing the work that are really creating the value. So if there ever was a time to look hard at our reward system and how skewed it is between the people who are doing the absolute necessary work to keep food on our tables, keep our elderly and our children taken care of, all of these basic needs that they're meeting, but getting so poorly rewarded for it. And we really need to turn that around.
So is there a way to combat this? Is there I've always said we need to go back to the good socialist president Dwight David Eisenhower's tax code. That's the only way we get to tap this stuff down to where the more they make, they're gonna have to pay in taxes. So the incentive to pay these obscene salaries goes down, and the incentive to pay people better may be there as it once was. But is there a way forward on this? Because it's when I'm looking at these CEO to pay ratios, they're just 400, 500, 600, 700, 800 times the one. It's insane to me.
It is insane. Well, we need various tools, and I support, a wealth tax and increasing taxes on capital gains and all that. But the most direct reform related to this problem of CEO to worker pay is the Tax Excessive CEO Pay Act, which has been introduced in the House and the Senate. And the way it would work is that the wider a company's gap between CEO and worker pay, the higher their corporate tax rate. So if you're a company like Walmart or Amazon or Home Depot, many other companies that are paying their CEO more than 500 times what they pay their median worker, they would have an increase in their tax rate of 5 percentage points. And there's graduated rates. If you're paying your CEO less than 50 times median worker pay, you wouldn't owe anymore under this. And there's movement on this at the state and city level. So two cities in the United States are already doing this kind of tax. Portland, Oregon has had it in force for a few years, and then San Francisco passed it through a ballot measure last fall. So those two cities will be generating revenue from these kinds of taxes, but it's also a way to incentivize companies to narrow their gaps by lifting up worker pay and reining in these ridiculous levels of CEO pay.
I got to tell you, I think 500 to 1 is totally ridiculous. I think that that needs to be reined in, and that's our target. That's the goal that we want to get to. And we're not even talking about what the 60s and 70s look like when you were talking 20 to 30 to 1. Now we're talking 500 to 1 is reining it in. Man, have things gotten out of hand.
Yeah, well, that's the highest tax rate would apply to those companies. But if you pay, between 50 to 100 times median worker pay, then you would pay, also a tax increase.
So okay.
It goes up like that. So it wouldn't just be on those very tippy top ones. There would be graduated rates. And you're right. There's no reason why we need to have executives making hundreds, if not thousands of times more than their typical workers. In 1980, the gap was, 40 to 1, and companies somehow were able to function. And, in my view, CEOs haven't gotten a whole lot more brilliant or highly functioning since then. So the extreme levels of CEO pay today have nothing to do with executive performance.
No, I agree with you. And it's one of these things where you go, I would argue that the CEOs of the last couple of decades have done more harm to their companies and done more harm to the country than they've done good. They should be paying us back.
Yeah, it's really hard to hold them accountable, especially when you have that much wealth. You tend to have excessive power as well. And so we're not just fighting the economic inequality, we're fighting the inequality in power. And as long as we have so much money in the hands of so few at the top, we're going to be battling them every step of the way when we try to fight for reforms that would be better for working people.
Yeah. Now, a lot of these companies, I've asked people, how many of these big companies who have these CEO pays through the roof and are, basically clawing these raises back from their workforce, how many of them took government money when we had that big giant trough of corporate money from the first pandemic relief bill? How many of them got stuff from that? Or are you able to look at that at all?
Well, I think most of the companies that we were looking at have too many employees to be able to qualify for the CARES Act, like the PPP program and so forth. Now, some of them did benefit, though, when the Federal Reserve funneled a ton of money into the bond markets and made credit more accessible. Carnival Cruise Lines, for example, would be one of those. There's also, of course, the airlines, got the huge bailouts in that first CARES Act. So, but we were looking at the lowest wage employers and with lots of employees, and most of them did not qualify for that bailout assistance.
So,
but they take in subsidies and taxpayer assistance in many other ways. There's no real big company in America that isn't relying on taxpayer assistance in some form or another, either tax breaks or government contracts or something. And that what that means is that we should have a lot of leverage over these companies. I think every tax dollar that goes to companies should come with conditions. It should require them to pay decent wages. I like creative ideas, like they should be required to put workers on their boards. Like a lot of European companies do. And, coincidentally, they have a lot narrower gaps between CEO and worker pay there. We could require government contractors to have collective bargaining agreements. I mean, we could get really creative with the power that we have, the power of the public purse, to put conditions on companies. And it's a really good time to talk about it, because a lot of money is going to be going out the door through the infrastructure spending to companies, and we should make sure that that is really well spent.
No, I'm right there with you, and I'm glad you brought up collective bargaining, because, you know, as someone who's been in the union for years, and someone who has helped negotiate contracts over the years, you know, sitting across from a CEO who makes 1,000 times what the average worker makes, that is a strong argument of why the workforce needs a raise. This is why I keep going back to, we need to reunionize this country. We need to get back to the days of 35% union density, so that we can sit down across from those CEOs and go, you know what, your nose has been in the trough long enough. You're taking too much of the work that we're performing and keeping it for yourselves. We want some of it.
Absolutely. And Rick, I have to tell you a really depressing story from my week this week, which was, we were planning an event today to release our report on CEO to worker pay. And I really wanted a worker perspective in the panel event that we did. And we had a worker lined up who was really eager to do it. It happened to be a worker who's involved in a union organizing drive in the workplace. And this person had to pull out at the last minute because the company had, I think, gotten wind of this and had really accelerated their intimidation tactics of this person. And it was so sad to me because it said so much about, well, here's why we have these huge gaps. Look at the power differential here. When companies can get away with these kinds of union busting tactics, and think about the stories that we don't get to hear, because people are afraid to speak out. And so, you know, the Amazon fight in Alabama really put a spotlight on these kinds of union busting tactics, but it is so much bigger than Amazon. And it was just such a sad statement to have to deal with this week, because it just said it all, right? It says so much about the power imbalance in our economy.
You know, as someone who's done organizing over the years, you see that look on people's faces when they know they can't, because they're worried about being able to pay their bills. And look, I empathize with them. You got kids Absolutely. To feed, you got bills to pay. The laws are so badly skewed, which is why I'm glad Joe Biden's talking about the PRO Act. I'm glad he's done some of the things that he's done, and I hope he goes further. And I hope the Democrats get their heads out of their behinds and really push for comprehensive total labor law reform this time, finally, because I don't know that there's going to be much time down the road. Real quick, back to the report. What are you hoping to get out of this, the 27th annual executive excess report? What are you hoping to get out of this?
I'm hoping it'll boost support for the tax idea that I talked about earlier, the Tax Excessive CEO Pay Act, which would incentivize companies to narrow their gaps, but also raise a lot of revenue that we could put towards good, you know, job creation and other things that we really need. Now is the time to be talking about this. We're in a debate over a really massive spending plan, and we need tax revenue raisers to help pay for that. And this is one of the ones that should be on the table.
There you go. Pandemic Pay Plunder, written by the good folks over at the Institute for Policy Studies. We'll get links out on social media how you can get the report and check it out. Sarah, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Thanks so much.
Great to be here. Bye-bye.
Good stuff. Sarah Anderson, Global Economy Project Director there, co-editor of inequality.org. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1894. That was the first day of the Pullman strike. The strike started in the company town of Pullman, on the south side of Chicago, where workers made luxury sleeping cars for passenger trains. As a depression swept the nation, workers had seen their wages slashed, but rents owed to the company owner George Pullman stayed the same. The strike won support from the American Railway Union and its leader, Eugene V. Debs. The American Railway Railway Union called for a boycott of all Pullman cars, and more than a quarter of a million railway workers participated in the work action against Pullman. The strike was crushed by legal injunctions and with federal troops. In a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court, Eugene V. Debs was imprisoned for his support of the boycott. One prominent supporter of the strike was Chicago area Reverend William H. Cardewine. The Reverend supported the strikers from his pulpit. After the strike, his book, The Pullman Strike, helped spread the word of Pullman. In it, he warned, "We as a nation are dividing ourselves, like ancient Rome, into two classes, the rich and the poor, the oppressor and the oppressed. On the side of the oppressor, there is power and protection, class legislation, and military support. We are following in the tracks of ancient Rome," he wrote, "instead of learning lessons from her failures and defeats. No country can prosper, no government long perpetuate itself and its institutions, which does not administer judgment and justice alike to all its people." These words from Reverend Cardewine seem more relevant than ever today. Will we heed his warning?
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, the big story today coming out of the Arkansas-Tennessee line there. The I-40 bridge, which I've gone over, going over the Mississippi River, evidently has a giant crack in it. There's a problem. One of the inspectors has come across this crack. Nobody's allowed on it. They've shut it completely down. And I'll tell you, my first thought, and this is horrible, my first thought was, they do inspections? We've got inspectors because you keep hearing all these stories of how, you know, we've been slashing and burning inspections. I was shocked they actually found it. But for me, this is another one of those stories on why we need to invest in our infrastructure. And here to share some thoughts on how maybe we do that. Maybe got some thoughts on the I-40 bridge. And thank goodness it didn't collapse into the drink. I've asked our good friend Scott Paul. He's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's great to be with you, as always.
So I'm glad it wasn't a tragedy. I'm glad we don't have a bunch of more fishing cars out of the Mississippi River. But giant crack, a major, major interstate, major commerce point, real problems.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you mentioned you'd been over that bridge. I've been over that bridge. That bridge gets hundreds of thousands of vehicles on it every day. And it is another data point that suggests that we're long overdue for infrastructure investment. The American Society of Civil Engineers gives our bridges a C grade, which is, you know, average, I guess, if you're a student, and I guess it's technically passing, but it's not great. It's not great. It means that, you know, for every bridge out there that's good, there's one that's not. There are something on the order of 50,000 bridges in the United States that are structurally deficient. There are 178 million trips taken over those bridges every day. So that's the kind of roulette I don't want to play, and I don't think anybody should have to play. And so I'm glad there's focus on infrastructure of all types, and in particular, with respect to bridges and roads. I think this is very important because it shouldn't take a tragedy to get a policy change or a new investment. And my sense is that the Biden administration realizes that. And so I'm hopeful that we can start this process of getting the American Jobs Act across the finish line and getting some of that much needed funding onto these states and localities so that they can both do maintenance and also rebuild bridges that are long, long overdue for replacement as well.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, this wasn't a tragedy because, as you've said, this is the main drag getting in and out of both of those states. This is a major commerce point. If this were to go down, I can't imagine the catastrophe that would have been.
Yeah, It's it'd be bad because right across from Memphis, major east-west point for a lot of commercial traffic, truck traffic, and just the idea that all of us are potentially driving over bridges every day that may not have this same inspection regimen and may have some of these cracks in them is obviously disconcerting, and so. Let's get Congress on the ball. And, again, I'm pleased that Biden, that the president is talking to Republicans to see if they're willing to come to the table on this. But ultimately, we need to get these investments across the finish line and get these resources out to the states and localities so that they can rebuild these bridges. It'll be good, obviously, for safety, as we've mentioned. It'll be good for the economy because it will create jobs in manufacturing and in construction, and it will be good more broadly for our competitiveness because it's hard to be competitive when you have a hard time getting your truck traffic across the country or your rail traffic or anything else in an efficient manner.
Now, does this move someone like Marsha Blackburn's vote to a yes, we need infrastructure vote or not? I mean, because ultimately it's going to come down to you need some Republicans to come on board. Tennessee is a Republican state. Arkansas, I mean, come on, there are four senators right there. Those are four votes going, yeah, obviously we need infrastructure investment.
Yeah. Yeah, we do. And it's interesting because when any of those officials have been statewide elected officials or local elected officials, they've been all for the infrastructure and trying to get the money into the roads and bridges. But something happens when they come to Washington and they lose those insights and it becomes very partisan. And it also becomes very, they don't want to talk about new revenue sources or even, rolling back tax cuts for corporations that used their last round of tax cuts to do stock buybacks and to ship jobs overseas. So I don't quite understand the logic, particularly if these Republican senators are trying to appeal to working class voters whose taxes wouldn't be touched by any of the proposals that that the Biden administration has made. But hopefully we can make some progress and. It should not take a tragedy to get something started, which is why I'm glad. Like there really is an infrastructure week, an infrastructure effort, infrastructure leadership coming from the administration. But now we need Congress to get behind this and get this moving.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like there's so many things every day that keep coming up. You're going infrastructure over here, infrastructure over the weekend. For instance, you had this Colonial Pipeline shut down. You've even got people like Ben Sasse going, we're not prepared. Which is why I've been saying infrastructure should be a national security issue. Maybe we run this through the defense bill, since that seems to be the only way we get things done.
Yeah. Yeah, I think for a number of different reasons. I mean, there's a lot to unpack with the Colonial Pipeline. I mean, obviously cybersecurity, a big concern there, and the fact that, private pipeline companies don't have systems in place that are able to deter cyber intrusions or ransomware is really disconcerting, to say the least. And this is critical infrastructure. You've seen, and I obviously live in the D.C. area, and there's panic buying of gas because people are uncertain about what this means in the days ahead. Now everybody's reassuring us that there's not a shortage and this will be perfectly fine. But Rick, it also begs the question of, why should we need to depend on kind of this archaic system of energy delivery when we can begin the transition to electric vehicles as well? That's going to be with the right cyber protections in place. Far more resilient, and we don't have to worry about shipments coming from abroad or from offshore platforms or anything like that. We got a lot of work to do to build up a new energy infrastructure, new energy systems, and new infrastructure. We talked about roads and bridges, but we got to do this for broadband. We got to do it for schools. We got to do it for childcare. There's lots of needs that we have to get our economy both back on track and then to make it more equitable and to have broadly shared prosperity as we look ahead.
And this is you brought up, you know, broadband access, and this is where I keep coming back to 5G. You know, we're not the world's leader in 5G technology, and this is the really important one. Because as it was explained to me, it's just not your cell phone and how fast you can look up whatever nonsense you're looking up on your phone. It's about how computers are talking to each other. It's about how automated vehicles are going to interact with each other. It's how our water systems and our critical infrastructure connect to each other. If we don't have that technology down, if we don't have that secure, we're extraordinarily vulnerable to, like you said, panic buying. Oh my gosh, they've shut the gas off for a day. Go get it all. And then it's going to be like toilet paper. You're going to see it on eBay for $100 a roll.
That's right. This is the perfect example, and I hate to do a history lesson here, but I'm going to, is when you have the mindset that it's okay to design and innovate here, but that you should make things somewhere else and we'll be okay. Well, all of this should shatter that notion, because our mindset was like, you know, and led by Apple and lots of these other tech companies, is we could design this stuff here, but we're going to make it in Asia. And so look what happens when it comes to 5G, and we're many generations into this broadband technology, and there's not really, an enormous American-made ecosystem for manufacturing this equipment that you need for 5G. We don't want to depend on Huawei, which has strong connections to the Chinese government and represents a potential security threat. But also we're going to have to depend on Nokia, Ericsson, other firms that are multinational. But we lost this kind of indigenous capability, because our attitude was like, we'll be fine. Someone else can make this. We'll just keep innovating, and we'll make the next best thing, and we'll be perfectly fine. Well, you know, that theory doesn't work. And in fact, some Harvard professors have shown that, Willie Sheehan and Gary Pisano, that when you lose the production, the innovation base slips as well. And so I think that the Biden focus on made in America, on investing in manufacturing, on investing in procurement and making sure it's Buy America, will be also very important to try to create demand and also the right incentives so that we are making that next generation of equipment here.
Yeah, see, I keep framing this, and I you probably won't come along with me, but I keep framing this as we're already in a type of in a new world of warfare. You call it manufacturing warfare, call it economic warfare. We're already in that. We're just losing. And we need to do like our grandparents' generation did, it ramp up production. We got to turn those machines on, get those factories operating, and start pumping this stuff out and doing the innovation that comes with that. Because you're right, the further away from the manufacturing line you are, the less innovation you can do. If you're not producing something, you're not tinkering with it, you're not changing it, and you're not innovating.
Yeah. Well, look, it's certainly a form of aggression. And the policies in particular from Beijing have been very aggressive that way in terms of their acquisition of intellectual property through non-legal means, what they forced American companies to do with joint ventures and what have you, and then just market access and a whole bunch of other subsidies. Meanwhile, we've been playing this very philosophical game, led by, unfortunately, Republicans for a long time. We're like, through deregulation and low corporate taxes, we'll be able to attract more manufacturing in the United States, and throw in a dash of free trade, with obviously the exception of Donald Trump, didn't buy that last part. But that got us nowhere. In fact, it set us behind. And so we're playing catch up. And we do have to realize that there is a public policy role. There's a role for making government investments, smart government investments, that can benefit and grow manufacturing, and that there's a different way to do that, and that it does matter where you make things, and that we are in competition, like you say, Rick. So I completely agree. And it doesn't mean that we need to be an autarky, that we are not dependent on anybody for anything. I mean, we're, you know, we do live in a globalized economy, but we do at least have to have the capabilities to make essential goods, make essential products, and certainly to recapture some of those markets that we've lost because of negligence over the last couple of
decades. And I would argue that the Chinese, they understand this war footing better than we do. Because they're spending on influencing us. And I'm sure you saw the Axios report that came out that China's increased their spending on influencing us like 500%. The kind of, you know, the stuff that they've been putting out, the social media influencing stuff, all of this, they've figured out from the Russians that it works.
Right. They do. And so they have like basically the state-owned media that has a presence in Washington that gets circulated around. They also hire Washington lobby firms to do their bidding for them. Squire Patton Boggs and some others have contracts with state-owned enterprises and the Chinese embassy and the government as well to do this. And you know, I kind of believe that everybody deserves representation, but when you're trying to spin genocide or aggression, I think that's more difficult to do to justify it. And so it is a that influence machine is enormous, and it's having an impact, unfortunately. And so I say this, and believe me, this should not be jingoistic. This should not be directed at Chinese nationals or Chinese Americans. This is about the actions of the government, of the Chinese Communist Party, and Xi Jinping, and his ruling class in particular, and what they've done. But it has to be countered. It has to be countered. And otherwise, they're going to keep on doing it. They're going to double down on influence or double down on the economic espionage and other forms of aggression like that.
Oh, and the currency manipulation, the intellectual property theft, which I don't really care too much about. If you went over there and you got ripped off, that was your fault. But there's a lot of stuff that they keep getting away with that we just keep going, oh, well, maybe next time we'll stop it.
Yeah. Well, look, I do think that one thing that the Biden team has discovered is that, Trump talked about these trade issues, but his policies were very erratic. And ultimately he made a deal with China that fell very short of what was needed. But Biden realizes we can't go back to the way that they did it in the Obama administration or the Clinton administration either. And so we will continue to press them and to suggest that we need a bold, strong approach with China, one that will allow us to reclaim some of our market share and hold them accountable by the rules.
No, I understand. Real quick, I got about a minute left. We're moving possibly forward on some Buy American legislation that, you know, maybe, you know, we start reshoring manufacturing, something like that.
Yeah, I think it's pretty great. So tomorrow, the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee is marking up a number of bills designed to make us more economically competitive, including about four or five bills that would strengthen our procurement laws, our Buy America laws that we've been working on for 8 or 9 years. So this is all of these bills have bipartisan support. So we're very much looking forward to that, and we hope that we can get these signed into law.
Now, you guys do amazing work, and I hope folks will check out your website. AmericanManufacturing.org is that website. Scott, always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us and sharing your expertise.
Rick, keep up the great work. Have a great evening. Thanks for having me on.
Good stuff. Our good friend Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Hello, I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing, so is your labor union. We are AFSCME.